Hello and welcome to the Ship Shape Podcast, a series of podcasts where we meet amazing people and talk about their experiences, personal, technical, and all related to the maritime world. Come and dive in, dive in.
This week on the Ship Shape podcast, we speak to Steve from Acorn to Arabella. Steve, alongside a small and trusty team, is documenting the building of a 38-foot wooden sailboat from stump to ship on YouTube, using old-school building methods and lumber from his historic family farm in Granby, Western Massachusetts. This week, we find out more about this incredible project from Steve himself and how they are planning to actually get it on the water next June. So my name is Georgia Tyndale, and I'm a freelance editor and writer within the luxury yachting sphere.
And I'm Meryl Charette. I'm a liveaboard on a Tashing Toshiba 36 in Boston, Massachusetts.
So thank you very much for joining us this week, Steve. It's absolutely lovely to speak to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
So, Steve, where are you recording this from?
I'm currently sitting downstairs in the boathouse. So the boat is right behind me and the downstairs workbench is right in front of me. And I'm in what the boat builders would call the moaning chair.
Oh, cool. So what, just to get us up to speed, what stage is she at the moment? I'm sure everyone's been following the videos religiously, but just for those who might not be quite up to date, where are we up to with the build?
Yeah, so we are gearing up to launch in June, like you said. So all of the hull planking is on, the deck is on. We're currently strip building and preparing to fiberglass the house sides, the house top, and the cockpit. So she's a mix of some really old school techniques and some modern ones as well. It's kind of a little bit of a hodgepodge. But the interior's like 80% there. There's still a bunch of electrical and fine finish stuff to do. But, you know, there's bunks and a head and a galley. We'll finish that up this winter. And we still have to do the diesel install, but that's all lined up for November. And then we're doing the sails with Doyle sails. And we got some work to do. So, you know, we got like a year's worth of work to do in the next eight months. But we'll get there.
Wow, that sounds very, that's classic boat, that is. A year's worth in 8 months. That's a pretty common scenario, isn't it, in boat building?
Yeah, for sure, especially when you set a deadline.
Yeah, I know all about missing deadlines, though I'm sure you guys will be absolutely fine. So if you want to just give us a bit of the backstory for those who might not be too familiar, give us a bit about the origin story of the project and what made you kind of decide to build a boat.
Yeah, so I've never sailed. I grew up fifth generation on a small farm in Western Massachusetts. So we're well over 100 miles from the ocean. And so it seems kind of far-fetched to be building a sailboat out here. But it was, I describe it as like a tickle in the back of my brain that I've had ever since I was a little kid. We would go up to Maine every once in a while and vacation and camp up along the coast, and I'd see these beautiful wooden sailboats up there, and I understood a house or a barn was built, but how you took timber and made it into this curvaceous thing that then went and sailed and seemingly had kind of a life of its own, and, you know, in a lot of instances would outlive the builders. You know, there was some mystique and some magic to that, and I just didn't understand how you went from having a tree and a board into, you know, a curvy wooden sailboat. And in 2011, I was on vacation out in Cape Cod. We had a really crummy, rainy day, and we went to a used bookstore, and I picked up this book called 50 Wooden Boat Plans. And that was the first time that I'd ever really looked at how a boat was constructed and sawn frames versus bent frames and all the different construction methods. There's quite a few different ones covered in that book. And I just found it utterly fascinating. I couldn't put it down. And over the next bit, I just picked up books and researched and read simply because I found it interesting and I was learning. And then I turned 30. And I sat down and did some kind of life reflection and I was the head route setter at a big climbing gym. So I made my own hours. I pretty much came and went as I pleased. I had a 401k, paid vacation, paid holidays, the whole shebang. But really, I wanted to travel and go climb big walls in Baffin Island and go to Patagonia and go backcountry skiing in Japan and go see the Baltics and the Med and deep water soloing in Vietnam and go see all of the amazing things that this world has to offer us, and realize that I was not going to accomplish that on 2 weeks vacation a year.
Probably not.
And it was at that point that I decided that I really wanted to build the boat, and it wasn't a someday thing. I knew I had a lot to learn, and there were a lot of pieces to the puzzle that were missing, but I felt like I knew where to begin. And I didn't really know how it would go or where it would end, but I knew how to start. So I did a lot of research into how to try to fund it, and that led me to some folks on YouTube sailing their fiberglass boats around the world and documenting that. And it took me a little bit to realize and kind of put together how those people were making that financially possible. And once I kind of put those pieces of the puzzle together, I was like, all right, if people will donate and support and contribute to follow folks sailing their boats around the world, maybe, just maybe, they'd be willing to do that to see some crazy farm kid who's never sailed try to build one.
Yeah, right.
So that's ended up starting the YouTube channel. It was a way to hopefully get the time and some of the funds we needed to build the boat. Having all of the trees on the property and being fifth generation and having access to space and timber, that's what really made it all possible. I mean, without that, there's no way on earth I would have even been able to begin. But I had a chainsaw and I had access to a sawmill, and I knew how to make boards, and that was the first step.
So how was it with your family when you suggested that you were going to cut the trees down and do this? Were they on board, or was there some resistance?
I wouldn't say resistance. I think at first it was like, yeah, huh, all right, sure, go ahead.
Yeah, you're really going to do this, yeah?
Yeah, like you're going to apply yourself at this for a week or two and call it quits, and that'll be fine. And when I really started in earnest and, you know, was piling up the logs and starting to build the building to build the boat in, I think the family was a little concerned. And, you know, we was working nights, weekends, holidays at the time. You know, I was working a full-time job and basically doing a full-time boat job. So
yeah,
had no free time for a couple of years. And the family was, and friends were all a bit concerned about, like, hey, you don't seem to be doing any of the things that you love to do anymore. And you're not spending time with anyone, and you're just going to work and going home and hurling yourself at this thing. And
yeah, because you were passionate about it, right? It was everything to you, I guess, at the time.
Yeah, it was. I was going to give it my all. And if I failed, I was going to not walk away saying, well, you know, I could have. It was like, well, I gave it everything I got, and, you know, I came up short. I was swinging for the fences. And then my take on it was always we would have to get it to look like a boat, that there was going to be a lot of early time of cutting trees, milling lumber, building a building, lofting floor, all of that. And we're talking a year's worth of effort before there's anything that even remotely possibly could be perceived as boat-like. So we never really thought that there would be a ton of interest in the earlier videos, but the hope was that if we got far enough that it gained traction and people joined, say now, when we are, you know, a year out from launch, that they would have a place to begin, and it wouldn't be a pile of lumber in a boathouse that came out of nowhere, that you'd be able to follow the journey from an empty yard and a forest of trees to a boathouse and a boat.
Yeah, for sure. So, but I gather you weren't alone making the videos. Who was it in the early days that you were doing this with? Because you didn't have like a video background yourself, did you?
No. So I am technologically illiterate. I'm great with basically anything pre-1980s.
Like, so you're good with like 1800 technology, basically.
Yeah. And that's just always how I've been. You know, to this day, if you want to put an app on my phone, like, someone has to help me figure that out, because I don't use apps. But my friend Alex, he went to school for photography and is all about the technology and super interested in that. And I knew that I couldn't make videos, but I thought that he could. So I pitched it to Alex and he was interested, and he moved down from Portland, Maine down to Western Massachusetts. And he was the early one filming and editing the videos. And then eventually the project grew after we poured the ballast keel, and YouTube was like, hey man, you want to see this video of these guys pouring 4.5 tons of lead? So the algorithm really worked for us on that one. And then we were able to hire a video editor, Ben Fundis. And that was a huge difference, having someone who could quickly and efficiently edit the videos. Editing, as I'm sure you know, just doing a podcast, is an insane amount of work, and something that I think people really drastically underestimate the amount of skills and time that takes. But yeah, and then it grew to Ben, and then we brought on Ian Bryant, and then Alex met an amazing woman and bought a house, and his dad had some health issues, so he moved on to other things in life. And then we hired KP to help push us across the finish line. And so, yeah, now it's the four of us.
This show was sponsored by
Boat RX.
Imagine it's the dead of summer and you're on your boat sweltering. Hell, you might even have that air conditioner running. But what about that nasty generator noise, huh?
Boat RX, an industry leader in highly efficient air conditioning on yachts. We produce power from a variety of sources when and where it's available. Whether that's with energy-dense batteries or high-power alternators, an efficient air conditioning solution can change the whole boating experience.
Your solitude or family gatherings won't suffer from that loud generator noise anymore. Get ready for summer. Check us out at www.boatrx.com.
Welcome back to the Ship Shape Podcast.
So it's hard to really like put into perspective how big this thing is, right? Like you said that you go to the Cape and you went to Maine. And when I see like these wooden boats, they're generally like smaller, but 38-foot wooden boat, just looking at your videos, it's just a very complex project. And with that, you know, it's like, where do you learn how to do that? Like, how did you figure out how to do all the planking and build the thing from scratch?
Part of it was growing up fifth generation on the farm here. So when I was a kid, my grandfather cut down the trees, sawmill came in, milled the lumber, and over numerous years, he built the barn. He built his house when he was in his 20s. So kind of the thought of taking on a big project like that, accomplishing it over multiple years, was just something I grew up with. I mean, you didn't have the money to buy the lumber and pay someone to build the barn. So you took 5 years and you cut the trees and you built the barn. So I think there was a lot of confidence coming into it from that. And growing up on the farm, I mean, the hay baler broke and the rain was coming. Like, you figured out how to fix it, or you figured out how to get the hay in. And so I think growing up with the older generations around and, you know, kind of seeing that ingenuity and that problem solving and all of the different things that just go into having a small farm, you know, there was a lot of that isn't directly applicable to boat building, but is very applicable to boat building. So like building a wooden boat, you're constantly moving heavy things around and wrestling things into position. And, you know, there's electrical and plumbing and all of these different things on top of the woodworking, metalworking. And I think the most versatile people that I've ever known in my life are honestly farmers and boat builders, because there's not much other industry where you have to really be a jack of all trades. And I've done a lot of woodworking throughout my life. So, you know, how to use a block plane and cut to a line and all of that, I knew how to do, knew how to use the tools. Certainly got a lot better with them over the last 6 years. But the boat specific knowledge itself, like how to hang a plank, how to spot, how to loft, even how to pick a design to build, that all came from reading and research. I haunted online forums. I have a massive library, and I read. I'm personally someone who learns very well that way. I can read it once or twice, and once I conceptually understand it, I will go and try to do it. And if I can't do it, I will go back to the reading and try to figure out where I went wrong. And for me personally, that worked really well. So when it came time to like figure out the 12 volt DC electrical system for the boat, I literally sat down for 4 days and read 4 electrical books and took notes and designed the 12 volt system and ran it past an experienced person and tweaked a couple things. And that's the electrical plan. So I've gone about basically the whole build that way. Early on, it was really just reading books and trying to figure it out. And then as the project grew and as we got better known, I got more and more offers from people like Thad Danielson or Harold Burnham or Lou Sazet. And, you know, they would say, hey, if you get stuck, give me a call. And getting those connections and starting to rub shoulders with those old salts a little bit, that definitely made a difference. Because, you know, it could take you days to hunt down something where if you call someone like Harold Burnham, who's, I don't know how many generations shipbuilder out in Essex, he's like, oh yeah, this is what you need to do, or this is what you don't need to worry about. And there was a lot of that that I learned talking with the old salts. You know, you read all the books and they're like 32nd of an inch and spile every plank. And you talk to the old guys and they're like, oh, heck no. You just do a good job off and you edge set those buggers. I mean, sure, we spile planks, but not that many of them. And learning like how the books talk about it and how the people actually doing the work go about doing it, that was definitely a big revelation.
Yeah. Can you explain a little bit more on that?
Yeah. So if you read the books, you know, they'll tell you you want vertical grain, quarter sawn planking stock. And in reality, I have yet to see a boat that's planked completely out of perfect vertical grain quarter sawn stock. You know, like I said, the books talk about spiling every plank. And then you go talk to a lot of builders and, you know, no, they'll cut a smiley face or they'll cut a frowny face so that it bends on the boat easier. But once you get to a boat of Arabella's scale and you're talking about 40 feet of plank, you know, you can edge set it. So a lot of the books, and it completely makes sense, like they write it to the highest standard. You know, they're setting the bar of if you are going to do this perfectly, this is what that looks like. And if you're going to go build a multi-million dollar yacht, by all means, that's what that looks like. But, you know, if you go watch the documentary Vanishing Sail, you know, those dudes are with a chainsaw and an adze on a beach in the Bahamas, and they're, you know, they don't have a level. They're using the horizon.
Yeah.
And the boats work great, and they sail and they fish and they race. And, you know, people have been building boats for millennia with far fewer tools and resources and knowledge than we have now. Yeah. So, you know, what you do for perfection and what you do to get a good, functioning, safe boat, you know, there's a lot of wiggle room there. There's a pretty big difference. And you read the books and they'll say you should run your block plane from one end of the plank to the other and the shaving shouldn't break. And if it does, go back and figure out why. And, you know, if you're building a 20-foot boat out of cedar, like, sure. If you are putting together 40-foot long oak planks, I would love to see somebody follow that rolling bevel for 40 feet in white oak with 4 glue scarves and get an unbroken shaving. I don't know how sharp your block plane is and how skilled your hands are, but that would be incredible to see. And it's just not really practical or obtainable in this particular instance. So reading the books and going through that, you know, some of it was really daunting, and getting to know some of the professionals and folks that have been doing it forever and getting to look closely at their work and getting to talk to them and see how they do things was really eye-opening. There are things that do need to be really tight and really perfect, and there are things that not so much. And I think life in a lot of ways is that way. If you try to make everything totally perfect, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what is this, just as you're talking now, I was just thinking about how this is, you know, how this has been for you as a project. Have you learned anything about yourself in terms of doing this project? Like, if you were naturally, you know, very much a perfectionist, that what you've described might be quite tricky. How has it sort of made you reflect about yourself and how you approach projects like this?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really makes me thankful for growing up with my great-grandfather and great-grandmother and grandmother and grandfather around, and seeing things that my great-grandfather built when he was in his teens or his 20s. So we're talking about the 1930s.
Yeah.
that are still functional and useful today,
yeah,
and are far from perfect and very ugly. And
like what?
Like just old pipe that he stuck into concrete and buried in the ground for fence posts. And they've got stuff welded to them and pieces of bolt through them that he never bothered to cut out or remove. But, you know, we've used that same fence post 5 different times and, you know, in 5 different places and move fencing and rip it up with the tractor and go bury that hunk of concrete in a different place.
Yeah, it's functional. It does what you need it to do, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and I've seen things that have... machines that we've bought that have come brand spanking new, and you go to change the oil on it and you're like, wow, I need 4 special tools and 1/2 a day just to get at the oil filter on this stupid thing. And there you have something that was designed and built by professionals. So I think growing up with the, you know, the kind of good old Yankee mentality of, you know, it has to work, it has to function, and as long as it meets those requirements and it's easy to maintain, then we're good to go. And I never came from a family that was like, it has to be perfect, and if it's not your best, it's not good enough.
Yeah.
I grew up with a grandfather who would chuckle and go, it's good enough for government work. And you know, and I think I was really thankful for that.
Yeah.
To grow up with that, because I think it was okay to make mistakes. It was okay to redo things that happened. Yeah. You know, and I think if I had come to this as someone who didn't have that like farming background and was, like you said, a bit more of a perfectionist, I think it would be all crippling to try to do something like this.
Yeah, because it's like it's the attitude of. I think what you've said about family support is so interesting, isn't it? Because it's that attitude of like, it's okay to fail and it's okay to not be perfect and it's okay to make mistakes, because I think there's different styles of parenting, isn't there? And sure. I think what you've described can just be so liberating, because it's like, you know, try this thing and have a go. And if it's not perfect first time, that's fine. You just keep grafting and keep trying. And I think that's really inspirational. And I think also the fact that you've seen other people make things, that must have had an influence on you, the idea that you can just have a go and do things for yourself rather than contracting out or waiting for someone else to do it for you.
Yeah, for sure. And I watched my grandfather and my great-grandfather scratch their heads and say, I don't quite know how to do this. And, you know, try it 4 different ways and get it on the 4th.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Thank you.
So, you know, obviously doing the whole boat building, I feel like it's relatively... it can be dangerous, right? You're moving heavy things around. You're using some pretty intense tools. What's the most dangerous situation you've been in? Like, what is the most dangerous tool you have? Like,
Hands down, bar none, logging. Going out in the woods with a chainsaw and a tractor or a skidder and dropping trees and getting the logs out of the woods. Hands down. Bar none, most hair-raising, dangerous part of the build. And I would honestly put logging and harvesting the timber as more risky and dangerous than pouring the 4.5-ton ballast keel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate that? How do you make it less dangerous?
There's only so many things you can do in the woods.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's just be careful. And, you know, it's another thing where I grew up with older generations around and harvesting timber and cutting firewood. And so I'd watch, you know, trees get hung up and how to deal with that and what to watch out for and, you know, how and why trees barber chair and go in directions you don't want them to go to. And it's not to say that I got it right all the time. That's for sure. We got plenty of trees hung up and had plenty of issues, but it's definitely one of those instances where, stepping back for a few minutes and taking a look at things and proceeding slowly and cautiously is the way to stay alive in that one.
But do you do that yourself?
Yeah. So I harvested almost all the trees that went into the boat. We got some black locust from an arborist in Cape Cod. I got a couple logs locally from some local arborists, but the vast majority of it, yeah, we went out in the woods and murdered the trees.
Yeah. So you take that risk on yourself, don't you, really, rather than involving someone else?
Yeah. The trees standing don't cost anything, and the mill is relatively cheap. Hiring somebody to fell them and get them out of the woods is not inexpensive. And if we had to do that early on in the project, I didn't have the funds for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I liked, I'm not sure if I'd read it or listened to it, but I remember you saying something quite beautiful about giving the trees a new lease of life. Can you just talk to me a bit about that? Because 95% of the lumber you say is from your own property and the trees are getting on a bit. So could you just explain that a little bit to us?
Yeah. So my family's had the property for five generations and we have some fields that we cut hay on, and hay is an annual crop and trees are a multi-generational crop. So we've harvested trees on the timber on the property for five generations, and we've cut our family's firewood every year from the property. But timber harvests, we do a small harvest every 10 to 20 years. So my grandfather did one to build his house. He did another one to build the barn. They did another one just to raise some funds and pay off some bills, you know, 10 or 15 years after that. So trees, like all things, they have a lifespan. And where we are here, we're at the base of the Mount Holyoke Range. So the soil is either very rocky or you're down in one of the bottoms and it's very wet. So the trees around here, they only get a certain size before either they're in the rockier soil and they get blown over because they have these big canopies and eventually a storm gets them and they go. Or if they're in the lower wetlands, that can still happen, but lots of times ants end up getting into them and hollowing them out. So the trees that we harvested, a lot of them, you know, they're not going to be around in 40 years. Some of them might, most of them won't. So by going in and harvesting a handful of those bigger trees scattered throughout an area, you leave all the other trees, they grow better and faster and stronger. So we didn't take any oaks that were under, say, 20 inches or so in diameter at chest height. And everything we took was that or bigger. And we left a lot of trees that are, you know, 14, 16, 18 inches in diameter at chest height. They have these great, nice, straight trunks because they grew up under the canopy of these bigger trees that were 24, 8 inches in diameter. And now that we've knocked out those bigger ones, we didn't damage the smaller ones in the process or selectively damaged the less nice ones, because sometimes you got to clear a lane to drop a big one. And then those ones, now that the canopy is opened up, they're going to put on girth and they're going to grow that much faster and better. So in a lot of ways, if you're doing small harvests like that, it's actually beneficial for the forest. And you can do it for a long time and forest will just keep coming back.
Yeah. And those trees get to come with you on the journey, right?
Yeah. And so instead of becoming firewood or, you know, going back into the soil, some of them went back into the soil, a little bit of it became firewood, and most of it gets to journey on in a boat and maintain. If I was an old oak tree, and I think being a wooden boat would be top of that list.
Yeah, we'll have to ask them, won't we? Yeah, awesome.
When we started talking about kind of like marine and maritime, like obviously a good, pretty much all the boats today are made out of fiberglass, and you know, there are very few wooden boats that you really run into, but they're all like beautiful and amazing. And, you know, everyone can see the work in them. So with the launch of your YouTube channel, have you had a lot of people reach out to you, you know, trying to build their own wooden boat and ask for advice?
Yeah, quite a few, actually. Nobody yet to this scale, but a lot of people building smaller wooden boats. Yeah, strip-built canoes, kayaks. I've got a 10-year-old kid who lives down the road and comes up and helps out 1.5 days a week and a bit more in the summer when he's out of school. And him and his dad recently built a little wooden rowboat together. So yeah,
you're getting the whole neighborhood involved.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we were at the wooden boat show in Mystic and a guy paddled up to the seawall in his kayak and pointed to the kayak and pointed to me and told me that the kayak was my fault. And, you know, he was obviously very happy and joking around. But yeah, no, we've had quite a number of people who have tackled smaller builds. We had one guy who came a few years ago and volunteered and helped out, and he stopped by last year and he had bought a small full keel cruising boat and spent all his money on it and found out later that the connection between the keel and the hull was bunk and the keel needed to come off and a ton of glass work needed to be done and the keel bolted back on. He did not have the funds to do it. But he said after watching the videos of us pouring the lead and building Arabella, he's like, if those guys can do that, I can fix my keel. And he and his girlfriend said that he would watch one of our videos and get himself like psyched up to go out and do battle. And he would go do battle and come back totally crushed and demoralized. And get himself psyched back up and go back at it another day. And it took him a while, but he got the boat fixed. He got the keel back on. He got it in the water and he's going cruising. And
amazing.
He said that he, you know, never would have even thought that he was capable of doing it if he hadn't followed the channel. And he doesn't think he would have stuck with it if he hadn't seen us sticking with it. And we've heard a lot of stories like that, boat related and life related and all sorts of other things. And that's something that I never expected starting this. But it's been really amazing to see the number of people who have drawn some sort of inspiration from this, and it's made some positive impact on their life. And that's been really, really amazing.
So if some person was deciding that, hey, I'm going to go build a wooden boat, what piece of advice would you give in the beginnings besides just do it?
Yeah, be prepared for a long, bumpy, challenging road. I mean, life's hard as it is. You know, things happen, speed bumps come up. I'm sure nobody saw COVID coming. You know, it's all of that kind of stuff is things are out of your control. And so when you do a big project, like life still happens and you have to figure that out. When I started this, people would ask how long it would take. And my standard answer was 2 to 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, everybody would laugh. It's, you know, I really looked at it that way. I was like, I don't know, maybe it'll take 2. I don't think it'll take 2, but maybe. And I don't think it'll take more than 10. So, but going into it saying like, there's a lot I don't know. This is going to be a long, bumpy road. Things are not always going to go right. This is probably going to take longer than I think it's going to take. I think going in with that attitude and perception makes all of the speed bumps and the delays and the hurdles and the mistakes a lot more palatable. If you're like, I'm going to build this boat this winter and I'm going to go sail it next summer, you know, that's a different undertaking than, hey, I'm going to go build this rowboat in my basement and I don't know, I'll get it done in the next few years and we'll go sailing. And, you know, being prepared for that long, bumpy road and not having a real firm deadline, I think takes a lot of stress out of it.
Yeah, with the YouTube channel, it's very easy to like edit videos and fast forward videos and do all that type of stuff. And, you know, people, I guess, don't necessarily see all the time because, I mean, you're living it, but everyone else gets to like experience it at like 100 times speed.
For sure. Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff we don't show. I mean, if KP and I spend 4 days sanding, you see 1 minute of Yeah, exactly. So you see a lot of the more intricate things and like closer to some semblance of real time, but the real monotonous, tedious, time-consuming things are all either not shown or sped up because, you know, who wants to watch someone sand for 4 hours or 4 weeks or 4 days?
There's some people out there. Maybe yeah, some background noise.
I was going to say some like ASMR or whatever it is. ASMR.
Yeah.
Background noise. Yeah, no, that's really cool. So I noticed when I was looking at your YouTube videos that you started off with, correct me if I'm wrong, but quite short and ones, and then they got longer and whatever. Do you have like an optimal length for your videos that you try and aim for in terms of maximum engagement and all the rest of it? Or do you just sort of do it, do what comes naturally?
It's a little bit of both. If we have our druthers, the videos will be like 20 to 30 minutes.
Yeah.
That's like a reasonable amount of editing time. It's a reasonable amount of footage. It's a reasonable amount of attention span for a lot of folks. But some weeks, if there's not a lot going on and it makes sense to cover it in a 15-minute video, then, you know, we'll do a 15-minute video instead of trying to create another 10 minutes out of not a whole heck of a lot. And by the same token, if it's really not something that's going to be easy to condense, then we'll put it out there. And, you know, we did the sail design and stuff and went met with Robbie Doyle recently. And that ended up being a really long video with a whole lot of talking. And it's just because of the nature and the information. And for our channel, it's always been about the journey of the wooden boat. And so that's fluid. It's ever changing. And I think if we tried to kind of like the timeline, if you try to fit it all into one certain box, challenging.
Yeah. So the sales thing's absolutely amazing. I gather he actually approached you rather than the other way around. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so actually everyone that we work with has approached us instead of the other way around.
Really?
Yeah. We have never gone to any company and said, hey, can we have this, do this, get this? Our motto has always been to go and do, and basically like the movie, The Field of Dreams, like if you build it, they will come.
Yeah,
and they are. Robbie Doyle came that way. So we had a guy who writes for the outdoor section of the Boston Globe want to do a little article, and that ended up becoming a front page article of the Boston Globe, which was wild. Ooh. Robbie Doyle is apparently a reader of the Boston Globe. So he
obviously
and sent us an email and said, "Hi, I'm Robbie Doyle, and I founded Doyle Sales, and I would like to design and sew your sails." And I, not being a sailor, came out to the boathouse and was like, "Hey, KP, have you heard of Robbie Doyle?" He's like, "Yeah, Doyle Sales. Yep. Heard of them." So I went to their website and was like, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. I recognize the logo, and they've done some amazing projects. And
yeah.
So we went out and met with Robbie recently, and he's at this point mostly retired and does a lot of golfing and pet projects. And it seems like he's really interested in the different set of parameters than what he normally works on. So he's done the sails for the Maltese Falcon and
yeah, exactly.
And all of these things. And basically, you know, there's one common denominator and all that, really, too. And it's a lot of money and it's go fast. And
yeah, whereas
as this is the complete opposite ethos of that. So we met with Robbie and he's like, "All right, so you're full keel and heavy displacement and gaff rig," and like, yeah, you could see the gears churning, and it's just a totally different puzzle. And he seems to be really enjoying that. And he told us that they've had tons of people over the years ask for sales and for donations of things, and that they want to go sail around the world, and that they've said no, and that he read the article and was like, "We gotta make sales for this guy." We got a log skidder early on, I think basically the same way. And I don't know where I came across this, if someone told it to me or I read it, but basically, if your car breaks down on the highway and you sit in your car, nobody's going to stop. If you get out and you open your hood, somebody may stop. If you get out and you start pushing your car down the highway, someone is going to stop and help you. Probably people are going to stop and help you. And I think we've had a lot of help and support that way. We had a guy stop by one day and he's like, "What are you guys doing here?" And so we showed him we were building the boat, and he's like, "How are you getting wood?" So we told him we were pulling it out of the woods with a log, with a farm tractor. And he's like, "You know how many people die a year pulling logs with a farm tractor?" I was like, "I don't know the numbers, but yeah, a lot, I know." I was like, "But it's what we have." And Peter said, "You know, I live up the road. I'm a retired logger. I've got a skidder sitting in my front yard. If you're going to do more logging, give me a call. I don't want to hear that you died under a farm tractor."
Aww.
And we needed more lumber. And I called Peter and we figured out how to get a skidder down here. And I had it for a winter, and we used it for the logging. And I think, you know, it's similar with Robbie Doyle. We weren't asking for help. We were going to sew the sails ourselves by hand, if that's what ended up being our only option. So I think seeing the gumption and that you're just going to go do it, people are really willing to help out.
Yeah.
So you're going to be launching the boat next June, right?
June, at Mystic Seaport. Yep.
So what are the feelings that you have internally thinking about that date approaching? And then also kind of with that, you know, when do you see yourself cruising? Are you just going to put the boat in the water and be like, "Okay, we're out of here"?
Yeah, no. So up until launch, I got a lot of work to do. So that's the main focus. And right now we're in basically triage mode. So we're doing everything that we have to get done before it gets cold, you know, gluing, painting. And then we're the priority list of everything that has to happen for the boat to go in the water. So yeah. I don't finish up locker space. I don't need to wire up the water maker. I don't need to put on the solar panels or the bimini or finish all of the running rigging. So we're going to get her to the point where she can safely go in the water. And then we'll spend a couple more weeks at Mystic and in the water doing the last bit of things that we've got to do for her to relatively function. But there's a lot that I want to do after I get a little bit of experience with the boat, because I've never sailed. So there's a lot that I need to kind of figure out what I want and what it's like living on the boat and the things that we want to store where and how the sails shade the deck and where do we want to put the solar panels and what is the path forward on the foredeck. And so I want to leave, you know, as much kind of unfinished as is reasonable so that we can do some sailing next summer and get a feel for the boat, and get a feel for living on her and cooking on her and what all that's like, and then spend next winter kind of doing the final big foot push to get all of those things buttoned up and dialed in. And then the summer of 24 will be the actual, like, honest to God first going cruising season.
Yeah, that sounds more sensible, having a bit of a dummy run and figuring all that out before you are like, okay, we're off.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to learn how to sail. So,
right? How hard can that be?
Yeah, well, it depends who you ask.
Well, when you were talking about how you were reading books and you just keep reading and then you figure it out. When I started sailing 5 years ago, I mean, that's the only thing I did. I'd never even been on a boat. So I just read, and then figured it out. Sure, it'll take a lifetime to become like the best sailor that you can be, but it's pretty straightforward. I think you'll be completely okay.
Yeah, and that's everyone that I've talked to that has built and sailed is like, if you figured out how to build it, you'll certainly figure out how to sail it.
Yeah.
So this boat's got 5 berths, right?
Yep.
Now, who are you going to be bringing with you? I mean, has that been a thought? Like, everyone on the team's like, oh, yeah, we'll just cruise around with you. Or what's that look like?
It actually looks a little easier than you'd think. So Ben, the video editor, he's got a wife and a young son and a movie theater in Newburyport. So he'll definitely come out and be on the boat a bit. But he is, you know, he's got no envisions of long-term cruising. Anne has her own boat. And KP has a partner and a kid. So KP will certainly be with us for the earlier sails. They've got their 100-ton captain license. They've, you know, done a bunch of chartering and they've got a lot of sailing experience. So looking forward to having KP on the boat a bunch that first summer and learning. But predominantly on the boat, it'll be me and my girlfriend, Robin. And for the first bit, a rotating crew of friends and captains and experienced people like KP. I really look forward to basically handing the reins over to a whole bunch of different knowledgeable people and seeing how they all would handle the boat. I'm sure they will all do things differently. And I really look forward to seeing and watching how a bunch of people are going to go about handling the boat. And then once Robin and I get to the point where we feel comfortable with her, then we'll take off to parts unknown.
Yeah. So have you planned where you want to go yet? Or is it TBC?
Nothing set in stone yet. I can say that Baffin Island and Greenland are calling my name really hard. I would love to go up and get on some of those big walls that drop right into the ocean up there. That looks amazing. So I think the 2024 will probably poke up towards that way. Maybe go up to like Hudson Bay and just get a feel for some more northern sailing and spend a season. And then I turned 40 May of 2025, and I would like to leave to head up to Baffin Island in Greenland then. And then after that, who knows, maybe we'll hop over to Norway, maybe we'll hop over to Alaska, maybe we'll go to the Caribbean.
Oh, Norway. I mean, all of those sound great, but Norway is amazing.
Yeah, like Norway.
The scenery and the fjords, it's incredible.
I've been inland Norway a couple times. I haven't been to the Norwegian coast, and that's high on the list. But I don't know, Squamish, British Columbia, Alaska, that's a tough pick.
Well, who says you have to pick?
Well, you'll have to pick one first.
First, yeah. A boat is for life, not just for Christmas, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we get asked all the time, like, are you going to sail around the world? And usually I'll tell people yes, but I imagine it's going to be a very long, circuitous route. And I'm an old cantankerous Yankee at heart, and there is maybe the chance that I will purposefully never cross my own path just so that I went all around the world, but never actually went around the world.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And are you taking any, do you have any furry friends that might be joining you on this trip by any chance?
Yeah, so I have a dog, Akiva, but is 11 years old. So I'd imagine he will be around for the first bit. Crossing any oceans.
Yeah, he's very cute. I've got a picture of him up here. I'm a big dog person and he's really cute.
He's a good one. He's very exuberant and he's pretty unflappable. So even though he's old and has never lived on a boat, he doesn't act old, and he's been out on motorboats and in canoes. And as long as I'm there and I'm fine, he's fine. So
he'll adjust as long as you're there.
I don't think he'll have a tough time. And this winter, we're going to do a lot of work on the interior. So it'll be a great opportunity now that the deck's on to have him really get used to the deck and going down below and the boat and all of that. That while it's here and on the hard and not moving, and that should make the transition getting onto the water a bit easier. At least it'll be a familiar space.
Yeah, for sure. And does he like fish?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, yeah, that was a very little puppy. He ate an entire bluefish.
Wow. Oh, bless him. That's so sweet.
Well, as we wrap this up, can you tell us where people can find you and read more about you and see your videos?
Yeah, for sure. If you do a search for Acorn to Arabella, you will absolutely find us. So we've got a website, we've got Instagram, we got Facebook, but the really big one is YouTube. So we put out a new video every Friday morning. So it goes out at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And pretty much every Friday, like clockwork, I think we miss like one or two a year. And there's a catalog of well over 200 videos now from us cutting the trees, pouring the ballast keel, digging out oak stumps and carving knees out of them all the way up until now. And we'll continue to follow the journey right through launch and onto the water.
Will you be awesome. Live streaming the launch?
Yeah, we will definitely be live streaming the launch.
Yeah, because I don't think we'll all be able to make it, sadly.
No, well, but I will.
We'll be there, but the rest.
It will be free and open to the public. So if anyone who wants to come to Mystic on June 17th, you are welcome. And as the time gets closer, we'll certainly be posting all the details.
Did
but
you
we
say
will.
June 17th, 2023.
Yes.
That's my wedding day.
Oh, wow. I guess you won't.
I don't know. I'll explain it to the fiance. He won't mind. Well, that's hilarious. I had no idea it was the same date. Meryl, you're double booked, mate.
Oh, man.
So thank you very much for coming to talk to us, Steve.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me on. It's an honor.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode. And be sure to like, share, and subscribe to ShipShape.pro.